Thanks so much, Larry, for the warm introduction, and thank you all for being here. It's really an honor to be able to give the Reese Lecture and follow in the distinguished footsteps of the many prior speakers. I'm going to talk today, as Larry said, about neighborhood effects and intergenerational mobility in the United States. And the work that I'm going to present is based on joint work with a number of colleagues, including Larry and Nathan Hendren, Emmanuel Saez, Pat Klein, Alex Bell, Xavier Jarvel, Neviana Petkova, and John Van Rienen in a set of different papers that I will talk about. So I'm going to start with just a very big picture overview of intergenerational mobility in a broad sense, thinking about the American dream, which can be quantified in different ways. Let's think about one simple statistic. The probability that a child born to parents in the bottom fifth of the income distribution makes the leap all the way to the top fifth of the income distribution, so the classic Horatio Alger version of the American dream. So how common is that in the United States versus some other developed countries around the world where we have somewhat comparable data? In the US, based on information from tax returns, which I'll talk about in a little bit, we estimate that your odds of climbing from the bottom fifth to the top fifth of the income distribution are 7.5%. That compares with 9% in the United Kingdom, 11.7% in Denmark, and 13.5% in Canada. Now, these are quite large differences in rates of upward mobility, especially when we recognize that you can't have more than 20% of people in the top 20%, right? Or to put it differently, the maximum rate you'd kind of expect to see is a transition rate of 20%. If your parents' income played no role at all in determining your outcomes, you'd expect one-fifth of kids from each part of the income distribution to end up in the top 20%. So one way you might think about it loosely is that your chances of achieving the American dream are almost two times higher in Canada than in the United States. Now, these differences across countries have attracted a lot of attention, created a lot of concern that the US might not be the land of opportunity, contrary to its reputation. But as we all know, it's very difficult to learn from such cross-country comparisons, macroeconomic comparisons, because there are numerous things that vary across these places. The first of which is just that the degree of income inequality is very different across countries. So maybe it's easier to climb from the bottom quintile to the top quintile in Canada just because the distance in a dollar sense is smaller. So what I'm going to focus on in this talk is instead variation in intergenerational mobility within the United States. In recent work with my co-authors, we calculate upward mobility for every metro and rural area in the United States by commuting zones. And we do that by using tax records on 10 million kids born between 1980 and 1982. So we're taking all children born in the United States between 1980 and 1982, essentially. And we measure their incomes in adulthood when they're roughly 30 years old, which is why we focus on these birth cohorts, where we're able to look at their incomes sufficiently far along so they're no longer still in college and so on. And then in what I'm going to show you, we're going to rank both kids and parents in the national income distribution. So even when we look at local area statistics throughout this talk, we're always ranking people in the national distribution. And we're going to assign kids to locations based on where they grew up. So if you grew up in Seattle and moved to Chicago, you're going to be still part of the Seattle data. So using that data, we construct this map here, which shows you the same statistic that I started out with, your probability of reaching the top quintile of the income distribution, conditional on starting in the bottom quintile. And the map is colored such that lighter colored areas represent areas with higher levels of upward mobility. So in the lightest colored parts of the country, like the center of the United States, you see rates of upward mobility by this metric that exceed 16.8%, higher than the numbers we saw for Denmark and for Canada. And at the other end of the spectrum, if you look at places like Atlanta or Charlotte or much of the Southeast, you see that the rates of upward mobility are lower than 5% or 4.5%, lower than any country for which we currently have data. So even within America, there's a really broad spectrum in rates of intergenerational mobility. Now you can see the broad patterns in this map for yourself. You know, the Southeast has much lower rates of mobility than the Midwest, parts of the West Coast, like the Bay Area, at least for kids growing up in the 1980s, had very high rates of upward mobility, and parts of the Northeast as well. You also see quite a bit of much more local variation, which I'll come back to later. So take a look at South Dakota and North Dakota, for instance, which let me just see if I can point out for the Europeans is here. So those two states, you know, have relatively light colors, but in the southwest corner, you see some of the darkest red colors on the map, right? So what are those places? They're the largest Native American, some of the largest Native American reservations in the US. So consistent with what we know historically based on anecdotal evidence, there's chronic persistence of poverty in those places, and that gets picked up in these statistics. Okay, so far I've just been focusing on one element of the transition matrix from the bottom fifth to the top fifth, but that's just a small piece of the data, right? So now I'm gonna move to thinking about the joint distribution of kids' and parents' incomes more generally by looking at just average outcomes of children. So to take an example of how we're gonna do this, I'm gonna look at the data for kids who were raised in Chicago and were born in 1985, so take one particular birth cohort, and we're plotting the mean rank of the child versus the parent's rank in the national income distribution. So what's the expected conditional expectation of the child's rank given the parent's rank? And you see a remarkably robust property in this graph that holds much more generally, which is that the conditional expectation of the child's rank given the parent's rank is almost perfectly linear. We find this in every area that we look at across time periods and so forth. There's something about the nature of the income distribution such that you get this linear conditional expectation function. That turns out to be really convenient because it means that you can summarize the degree of mobility in an area just using two parameters, the slope and the intercept of that line, right? And so I'm gonna, for concreteness, focus on one particular percentile. I'm gonna look at the mean income rank for children with parents at the 25th percentile of the income distribution based on that linear prediction, just to pick something concrete to focus on, but we can look at other values as well. And so when you do that, so in Chicago, the mean rank that kids reach starting out in families at the 25th percentile is roughly the 40th percentile. We can do that same calculation for all the commuting zones in the US, and you get a map that looks pretty similar to the bottom quintile to the top quintile transition that I showed you. It's not identical, but broadly you see the same patterns, right? And so that's why I started out with that simple statistic. It's representative more broadly the rates of mobility that you see. Okay, so now, given that background, so just descriptively, we see a lot of variation in children's outcomes across areas in the United States. So naturally, the next question is, you know, why does mobility vary so much across places? And there are two very different explanations for the variation in children's outcomes across areas. One is that it's about selection. Different people live in different places. The people who are in San Jose or Salt Lake City are obviously different from the people in Atlanta or Charlotte. Alternatively, this could be about neighborhood effects. That is, places have a causal effect on upward mobility for a given child. Now, there's a long literature going back to work that Larry has done and many others in this room, work by both economists and sociologists about these competing explanations. And there's famous work by William Julius Wilson, Massey and Denton in sociology, Cutler and Glazer, the MTO experiment, which Larry and many others have been involved in, Joe Altonji's more recent work, and so forth. And there's somewhat of a tension, I would say, in this prior literature where observational studies tend to show that, consistent with what I was showing you, there's a lot of variation in people's outcomes across areas that's not readily explained by differences in demographics or other observable factors. However, the gold standard experimental evidence from the Moving to Opportunity experiment at least traditionally, found very little evidence of changes in economic outcomes when people move to what appear to be better areas. There are significant effects on health and well-being, but on economic outcomes, you don't find much. And so I think that's left the literature on neighborhood effects at somewhat of a standstill, because observationally, you seem to see that where people are matters a lot, but when you actually do an experiment, you don't find that much. So what we do in our recent work with Nathan Hendren is revisit that debate and try to identify the causal effects of place by looking at movers. So we study 5 million families who move across commuting zones or counties in the tax data, And recognizing, of course, that where people choose to move is endogenous, and so you're not going to be able to learn from just comparing families that move to different places, the key idea of our approach, which I'm going to spend the next few slides on, is to exploit variation in the age of the child when a family moves in order to try to isolate causal effects. So I'm going to describe the way our research design works in a series of steps and what the key identification assumptions are and so forth. Let me start with this. So what we're going to do is regress, take the subset of families that move, and regress the mover's income rank at age 26. We're going to measure kids' incomes at age 26. We can vary that age. It doesn't matter a whole lot for the results. We're going to regress that rank on the expected rank of the permanent residents in the destination. So that is, take the set of families that never move, call them permanent residents. They have a certain set of outcomes which are similar to what I showed you on the initial maps. And now take the movers, and let's let the movers rank be denoted by yi, and regress that on y bar pds, where y bar pds denotes the expected rank of the child, given his parents' income percentile, given the destination to which he moves, and given the birth cohort S to which he belongs. And that Y bar PDS is constructed using the conditional expectation, the linear conditional expectation, along the lines of what I showed you for Chicago. Okay, so essentially we're comparing the mover's outcomes to the outcomes of the permanent residents in each area, and we're gonna include parent decile by origin, by birth cohort fixed effects, so that identification is coming purely from variation and destination. So think of the experiment as, take two kids who live in Dallas initially, and say when they're 13 years old, one of them moves to San Francisco, one of them moves to Atlanta, and we're gonna compare their outcomes, okay? And relate them to the outcomes of the people who were already growing up in Atlanta or San Francisco. So this chart, let me start by just giving you a visual depiction of what you get out of running a regression like that. And I'm gonna start by looking at the kids who are exactly 13 years old at the point at which they move. So on the x-axis here is the predicted difference in the child rank based on the permanent residence in the destination versus the origin at the same income percentile. So for instance, on the far right, the plus six, these are kids who are moving to places where kids growing up in families at their income level are ending up about six percentile points higher on average relative to where they started out. So that's like a move from a place like Atlanta to the Bay Area. At the other end of the spectrum are people making the opposite move, moving from the Bay Area to Atlanta and ending up in a place where kids are doing six percentile points worse on average. What we're plotting is the rank of the movers now versus the rank of the permanent residents. And rather than just doing a raw scatter plot, we're doing a bin scatter plot where we divide the x-axis into 20 equal sized bins, and we're plotting the mean of the x and y variables within each of those bins. So you can see that there's a very strong relationship between the movers' outcomes and the permanent residents' outcomes. When you move to a place where kids are doing a lot better, you yourself have much better outcomes in adulthood, and likewise, symmetrically, when you move to a place where people are doing a lot worse, you yourself have much worse outcomes. The slope of that line for kids who move when they were exactly 13 is about 0.6, okay? So now I'm gonna repeat this analysis, looking not just at age 13, but also at subsequent ages. So this chart here plots the slopes of those lines, estimating that regression separately by age, versus the age of the child when the parents move. It so happens, given currently available data, we're only able to go back to age 9. That's why the graph starts there. And what you can see is, at age 13, we saw the slope was around 0.6, and then you see the steadily declining pattern as you go to older ages, and then this flat pattern after about age 22. So let me talk about what you see in this graph in a couple of steps. Let's start on the far right over here. So on the far right side, you see that the coefficients remain positive at roughly 0.2 even after age 26. So when your parents move to a better place, even after you're 26 years old, you seem to have better outcomes. So that obviously can't be a causal effect because we're measuring your income at 26. And so that shows you that there's some selection consistent with what you might expect in where parents move. If your parents move to a place like San Francisco, it's a signal that you're in a different sort of family. and that's associated with different outcomes on average. Now, if you go, let's now look at the first part of this curve. Now, what the pattern you see prior to age 22 is that these slopes are declining steadily with age. That is, you seem to converge to the outcomes of the people in the destination to which you move the earlier you get there. Now, in order to interpret that slope, which is what I'm going to be interested in focusing on these exposure effects, in order to interpret that as the causal effect of spending more time in the place, we're going to make one critical identification assumption, which is that the nature of the selection that I just described does not vary with the age of the child when the parents move. So the extent to which the families were different, you know, when they moved to San Francisco, if that's true at age 15 or age 20, we're going to assume that it's just the same pattern at all ages, right? The same degree of selection. So visually, you can think of that as tracing out that horizontal line at the end directly to the left all the way through and attributing that much of the effect to selection. Under that identification assumption, you can then interpret the slope of the line on the left side as the causal effect of spending one more year in a place where kids are doing one percentile point better. And if you look at the slope of that line, it's about minus 0.04, so that is every extra year you spend in an area that's generating better outcomes, you yourself get about 4% of that effect. Or if we integrate over, say, 20 years of childhood, roughly, you're picking up something like 80% of the effect as the causal effect of the place. Now, this analysis relies critically on this assumption that selection does not vary with the age at which people move. Now, of course, you might worry that that doesn't hold. There are many plausible stories you can tell for why that might not hold. To take one example, maybe the families who figure out that Atlanta is not a good place to raise their kids at an early age, they tend to be families that are investing more in their children in other ways. They're more educated, more sophisticated. And that's why we're seeing better outcomes for kids who moved out of those types of places at younger ages. That would violate this constant selection assumption and would make this 0.04 estimate a biased estimate of the effect we're after, right? So there are a couple of ways we do a bunch of things to try to evaluate the validity of this assumption. The first, which is quite intuitive, is to put in family fixed effects and compare siblings within the same family. So if you're worried about factors that are stable within the family, right? So the story I just told, some families are investing more in their kids than others, then by comparing siblings within the same family, you knock that out. And you can see that when you do that and replicate this analysis, you get exactly the same picture. So that is when a family with a 9-year-old and a 13-year-old moves from Atlanta to San Francisco, the 9-year-old is doing better than the 13-year-old on average, exactly in proportion to that 4-year age gap. So that takes off of the table any biases that are due to fixed factors that vary across families. But there's a second category of omitted variables that you might worry about, which are time-varying unobservables. And so in particular, the types of concerns we might have are that when a family moves to what appears to be a better area, they're also getting a better job, or they're moving to a more stable family structure, or there's a positive wealth shock, something else that's good is happening at the same time. And that type of correlated change would again create bias in these estimates because that change in the family environment might affect kids in proportion to exposure time. So let me show you a couple of ways in which we try to address those time-varying factors. One simple thing you can do in the tax data is control for changes in income and control for changes in marital status, which people usually think of as the two main factors that we worry about. We see these very well in the tax data. So we can include controls for income over the 17 years that we observe. We can include controls for whether you're married or not. And you can see that that hardly changes the figure. So to the extent there are other time-varying confounds, they have to be essentially orthogonal to income and marital status. You might still worry about unobservable shocks. So that by itself, I think, is not definitive. So you might worry that, for instance, there are changes in wealth, which we can't see in the tax data, that are confounding the analysis. And so I'm going to talk about two types of approaches that we use to deal with these confounds. The first, which is familiar, and the technique we tend to use in many places when faced with such a problem, is to turn to experimental variation. The core identification problem here stems from the fact that we don't know what triggered the move, right? We don't know what made families move from one place to another, and so we worry that whatever triggered that move might also be responsible for the changes in outcomes that we're seeing. And so one way you can deal with that problem is to look at a case where you do know what triggered the move. For instance, if you had randomized variation in incentives as we did in the moving to opportunity experiment. And so I'm going to come back to talk about the MTO evidence in a little bit. A second approach, which I think can be very powerful, particularly in these large data sets where you have a lot of precision, is what I'll call a set of outcome-based placebo or over-identification tests. And so let me describe to you how those work, just at a broad level without getting into the details of the specification too much. So the general idea is to exploit the fact that there's a lot of heterogeneity across subgroups that allows us to construct a set of over-identification tests of this exposure effect model. So for example, the exposure model predicts convergence to the permanent residence outcomes, not just on the mean, which is what I've been focusing on, but across the entire distribution. And this turns out to be useful because there's variation in the distributions across areas that's quite meaningful. Let me give you an example. It turns out that the variance of earnings for children of permanent residence in San Francisco is higher than the variance of earnings for children of permanent residence in Boston. Turns out that if you're growing up in a low-income family, on average, you get to the same place in Boston and in San Francisco, but San Francisco appears to be more likely to put you in the tails, in the top 10% or in the bottom 10%, just generates more variance. So if San Francisco is having a causal effect of that type on kids' outcomes, we'd expect that children who move to San Francisco at younger ages should also be more likely to end up in the tails, right? You should see a convergence at all quantiles, not just at the mean. In contrast, I think it's less likely that whatever unobserved shock we're worried about, like a wealth shock, would fully replicate the distribution of outcomes in the destination area in proportion to exposure time. At least ex ante, you wouldn't have expected that an increase in wealth would have a different effect if you moved to San Francisco or Boston, exactly in proportion to the nature of the distribution and so forth. And so building on this, applying this logic, let me quickly show you how those results look. So instead of looking at the outcomes being the mean rank of the child, which is what we were focused on before, I'm going to define the outcome of interest as being in the upper or lower tail of the distribution, being in the top 10% or being in the bottom 10%, which is essentially an indicator for whether you're employed or not. Okay? And I'm going to regress those indicators on what I'll call a distributional prediction. So an estimate of the place effect constructed based on the permanent residence in the same way as before, but for the relevant quantile. So what is the rate at which San Francisco or Boston puts you in the top 10%, et cetera. And I'll also compare it to the effect of the place on the mean rank, which is what we were focused on before. So what you can see in the first column is if I regress the outcome of being in the top 10% on the place effect for being in the top 10%, I get this familiar exposure effect coefficient of about 4% per year. Now, if I regress it on the mean rank, I get about 2% per year. You still get a positive coefficient. That makes sense because places that are more likely to put you in the top 10% also generate higher outcomes on average, right? Those two things are positively correlated. Now, the critical test, which I'm calling the placebo or over-identification test, is in the third column where I put in both of those predictions together. And you can see that the effect loads entirely onto the distributional prediction, and you can reject with quite a bit of precision that there's any residual effect of the mean rank conditional on the distributional prediction. So that's the placebo test, right? So that's basically telling you you converge exactly by quantile to the place where you're moving. It's not just generically that when you move to a place like San Francisco, in a loose sense, you do better. No, you actually are converging in exactly the way you'd expect across the quantiles of the distribution. And likewise, in the right columns, you see the same thing is true at the bottom of the distribution. Now, more generally, we find similar convergence to the outcomes of permanent residence in the destination by gender and also by birth cohort. So if you cut the data in other dimensions, concretely moving, it turns out some places appear to generate particularly good outcomes for boys and some are particularly good for girls. moving to a place where boys have especially high earnings makes the son have better outcomes in proportion to exposure time, while the daughter's outcomes don't change. So once again, you know, if you were worried about an emitted factor, ex ante at least, you wouldn't have expected that emitted variable to generate differential effects by gender that exactly match where you're moving, et cetera. So we conclude based on a bunch of tests like this that the timing of move design yields pretty good estimates of neighborhoods' causal exposure effects. That is, they show that every extra year you spend in an area where people are doing one percentile better appear to increase your outcomes by about 4%. Okay, so now the next step in this analysis, we've seen that it seems like on average neighborhoods seem to matter. A lot of that variation in that map I showed you initially seems to be due to place effects rather than different people living in different places. What I want to do next is present a set of estimates that are completely purged of selection. And so we're going to do something more ambitious. Rather than estimating that single 4% number, we're going to try to estimate the causal effect of growing up in each county in the United States. So estimate these 3,000 causal effects. And we're going to do that by using the same exposure time design and estimating a fixed effects model using these 5 million movers across areas. So again, without getting into the details here in the interest of time, let me just give you the intuition for how this works. So we see in our data the children who move from Manhattan to Queens in New York at younger ages earn more as adults. So the earlier you move from Manhattan to Queens, the better you're doing when we see you as an adult. So from that, based on the type of logic I was showing you, we can infer that Manhattan appears to have a Manhattan has a negative effect relative to Queens. Right? Queens appears to be better than Manhattan. Now, following that line of reasoning, you have 3,000 counties, origins and destinations. You can imagine there's a matrix of these pairwise comparisons, right? You can, what's the effect of spending an extra year in Manhattan versus Queens, Manhattan versus Bronx, Bronx versus Queens, et cetera, for all the counties in the US, right? So we take that matrix of estimates and project it onto a vector of fixed effects, essentially assuming an additive structure. So the effect of being in Manhattan versus being in Queens is the Manhattan effect minus the Queens effect. And we identify these fixed effects purely from differences in the timing of when people make these moves. So we're not comparing the people who move from Manhattan to Queens to people who made a different move. We're just comparing people who moved at different times within a given pair. We then do another set of things, which I'm not going to have time to talk about in detail here. Because these fixed effect estimates by themselves are somewhat noisy, particularly in smaller counties, we apply a shrinkage procedure to construct mean squared error minimizing forecasts that gives us what we can interpret as an estimate of the causal effect of each place that minimizes the overall mean squared error of the predictions, okay? And then finally, in the results I'm going to show you, just to facilitate interpretation, I'm going to scale the estimates not in percentile terms, which are a little bit hard to think about, but rather as percentage changes in earnings per year of additional exposure. Okay, so here's an example of what you get from this kind of analysis. So here I'm showing you the data at a county level in New York, the estimates of these causal exposure effects. And again, lighter colored areas represent areas that generate more positive outcomes. Under the identification assumption of constant selection that I described initially, we can now interpret these as the causal effect of putting a given child at the 25th percentile of the parent income distribution in each of these different places in the New York area. And you can see that even within the New York metro area, there's quite substantial variation in children's outcomes depending upon where they live. So to take an example, if you're in the Bronx, we estimate that every extra year you spend growing up in the Bronx reduces your earnings by about 0.5% over 20 years of childhood. That would reduce your earnings by 10% relative to the national mean. In contrast, if you're just across the Hudson River in Bergen County, New Jersey, we estimate an increase in earnings of 0.7% for each year of exposure, translating to something like a 14% gain over childhood. So even in relatively narrow geographical areas, you see quite substantial differences in causal effects on children's outcomes. That is, neighborhoods really seem to matter. So that was the data for New York. Let me just give you a picture of what this looks like more broadly across the United States. So here we're listing the top 10 and bottom 10 counties in the US based on these estimates of causal exposure effects for kids in low-income families. And at the top, you see the western suburbs of Chicago, DuPage County, Illinois. You see Snohomish County in Washington, right here in Seattle. And then Bergen County, New Jersey, a bunch of places, California, Norfolk County in Massachusetts, and so forth. And then at the bottom, you see a variety of places that include Wayne County in Michigan, the city of Detroit. And then at the very bottom, I think it's striking that it comes out this way, the city of Baltimore ends up being at the very bottom of the list with an estimate of minus 0.86. So we estimate that, you know, you're losing on average something like 18% of earnings relative to being in an average place if you're growing up in the city of Baltimore, consistent with recent events in that city. Now, it's also interesting to break this down by gender. So this now replicates the same analysis I showed you before for boys. And you see that a similar set of places appear, but the effects are especially pronounced in the lower tail for boys, and in particular in Baltimore, where now the effect is minus 1.4%, something like a 30% earnings loss spending 20 years growing up in Baltimore relative to other places. In contrast, if we look at girls, you continue to see correlated patterns, which makes sense. Places that are good for boys also tend to be good for girls in general, but you don't have that extreme lower tail set of outcomes in places like Baltimore. So we generally find that the variance across places is smaller for girls than boys, and in particular, you chop off this extreme lower tail. And that's consistent with a growing body of evidence, work by David Auter and many others, which suggests that girls appear to be more resilient in the face of poverty and hardship than boys. And I think you see that in the context of neighborhoods as well here. Okay, so hopefully convinced you that it seems like where you grow up really matters in a substantial way for long-term outcomes. So stepping forward now and thinking about, okay, what can you do to try to improve upward mobility in light of that finding to improve opportunities for disadvantaged youth? I think there are two ways to think about the problem. So one thing you might think about doing is just helping people move to better areas, right? So this is quite a sensible thing to think about, particularly in light of the fact that we spend about $45 billion per year in the United States on affordable housing policies of various kinds, $20 billion of which goes to Section 8 housing voucher programs, which give families assistance in renting apartments and houses. Most of those vouchers are currently used to rent apartments in areas that are relatively low opportunity, high poverty areas. And so there's a margin there which one might be able to push to get more families to use this money more effectively to live in higher opportunity areas. Moreover, while it might seem awkward to try to pluck families from where they're currently living and move them somewhere else, it's important to recognize that a quite substantial fraction of low-income families actually move locally within a given year. So think of this not so much as taking a family that's never going to move and moving them somewhere else, but rather trying to redirect the flows among families that are already moving, perhaps for other reasons. So that's one approach you might think about, and I'll talk about it in more detail. Another possibility, recognizing that you can't possibly just move everyone, you know, your solution can't be to move everyone out of Baltimore, is to figure out how you can invest in places with low levels of opportunity to replicate the successes of areas that appear in the brighter colors on the map. So let me talk about each of these in a little bit more detail. So on the first approach, we've already tried something like that in a very well-known experiment, which many of you know, the MTO experiment, which gave families vouchers to move to lower poverty neighborhoods using a randomized lottery. The MTO experiment involved about 4,600 families in five large cities around the US in the mid-1990s. And it's been widely studied by economists, sociologists, and others, as I mentioned earlier. Now, what we do here in recent work, joined with Larry and Nathan Hendren, is link the MTO data to the tax returns that I've been using for the earlier set of results in order to test for childhood exposure effects. The earlier studies of MTO that Larry and others had conducted were able to look at the outcomes of older youth and primarily at adults, partly because of data limitations, that the younger kids just weren't old enough to be able to see their outcomes. And so in light of our findings from the quasi-experimental analysis with Nathan, we wanted to understand how that fit together with the evidence from MTO. And a natural hypothesis was that maybe if we look at the younger kids, we'd find bigger effects there. So we went back to the MTO data and redid the standard treatment control comparisons that people have done. Just to give you a concrete sense of what this looks like, let me show you an illustration of what these moves look like in New York City. So in New York City, families in the control group who were not eligible for these housing vouchers, which were assigned by lottery, many of them started out and tended to live in a large public housing project called the Martin Luther King Towers in Harlem. Many of the families who received an unrestricted Section 8 housing voucher through the lottery moved to places like Soundview in the Bronx, about 6 miles away from the MLK Towers. And families in the experimental group who received a housing voucher that was restricted to be used in a low poverty census tract with less than a 10% poverty rate moved to a variety of places, but tended to move. A common destination was Wakefield in the North Bronx, about 10 miles away from the MLK Tower. So these are really narrow moves, right? Short distance moves. And essentially what we're going to be doing is comparing the outcomes of kids who grew up in these three places. And so this is a simple comparison of means. I'm just going to show you very quickly a set of bar charts that summarize the findings in a simple way. So on the left panel here, we're plotting the earnings of kids who grew up in the control areas in the gray, the Section 8 areas, the kids assigned to the Section 8 voucher group in the blue, and kids assigned to the experimental voucher group in the red. So on the left side are intent to treat estimates, where we're just including reporting raw estimates. Think of it as just basically a raw comparison of means for the people assigned to these three different groups. And you can see that the kids assigned to the experimental voucher group are earning about $1,700 more, $13,000 relative to $11,300 than the kids in the control group, a difference that's significant with a p-value of about 0.01. Now you can rescale those estimates to get so-called treatment on the treated estimates, taking account of the fact that roughly 50% of the people who were eligible for the experimental voucher actually took it up. And so if we make the natural assumption that the treatment effect is coming from the people who actually moved, we can see that the treatment on the treated estimate is something around a gain of $3,500, roughly a 30% gain in earnings relative to the control group. So quite a substantial change in children's earnings. When we focus, and I should have emphasized this from the beginning, this is focused on the subset of kids who moved at relatively young ages, who moved before they were age 13. So that's earnings. We also see similar gains when we look at measures of college attendance, where you see college attendance rates going up in the treatment groups, the experimental voucher group relative to the control. And likewise, if we construct an index of the quality of the colleges based on the earnings of the graduates of each college, which we can see in the tax records, we also see that kids appear to be attending better colleges conditional on attending. So on a broad spectrum of outcomes, including many others that we discuss in the paper, we see quite significant gains for children who moved at relatively young ages. In contrast, if we repeat that analysis for kids who moved at older ages, between the ages of 13 and 18, you see here that there's no evidence of a gain in the experimental group relative to the control. If anything, the earnings levels look slightly lower in the experimental group relative to the control group. So that's exactly consistent with that declining pattern that I showed you initially, that we see bigger gains from moving to a better area if you move when young rather than when you move when you're old, consistent with the importance of childhood exposure. So I think the MTO data shows you that a policy that tries to help families move to better areas through financial incentives and assistance, counseling and so forth, can be actually concretely be quite effective in improving the outcomes of disadvantaged youth and increasing upward mobility. So that's one approach that I think is promising and worth pursuing further. Now, there are limits to the scalability of that strategy. And so you also need to think about policies that might improve existing neighborhoods. Now, this is a very hard thing to figure out. Figuring out the causal effects of local policies, what exactly is making the Bay Area generate better outcomes than Cleveland and so forth is quite difficult to do. So I'm gonna do something much simpler than that just as a first step. I'm gonna characterize the features of areas that generate good outcomes. I'm gonna show you a bunch of correlations. What are the systematic properties we find of places that seem to generate better outcomes for kids than the places that have more negative causal effects based on our estimates? And so I'll quickly summarize that with this chart here. We've looked at a variety of different factors that economists and sociologists have talked about over the years. And in the interest of time, I'm just going to highlight some of the strongest correlations we find in the data. So what we're doing here is correlating our estimates of the causal exposure effects for kids at the 25th percentile of the income distribution with various area level characteristics across commuting zones. Let's start with the fraction of Black residents. We find that places with a larger Black population tend to, on average, be places that have more negative causal effects on kids' long-term outcomes. So a different way to say that is the areas where African Americans tend to live are places like Atlanta, places like Memphis, Tennessee. These tend to be places that have more negative effects on kids' outcomes for both Blacks and whites based on our movers analysis, right? So importantly, we think this is the causal effect of place. It's not picking up the effect of race because we're identifying this off of the movers. And so what you see from that is, you know, you might ask, so what is driving that correlation with the fraction of Black residents, even for white kids when they move into a given area? There could be a variety of things going on. Places with larger Black populations are known to be more segregated. They tend to have less investment in public goods due to the historical legacy of where Blacks ended up in the US and so forth. And so through a variety of mechanisms, you see this strong correlation. It's important because it suggests that place effects might significantly amplify racial inequality. So a significant portion of the Black-white earnings gap might simply be attributable to the fact that Blacks grow up in areas that appear to be worse in terms of generating good outcomes than whites. Now, the other factors give us a little bit more insight into what might be varying across these places that's actually mattering. So we see that more residentially segregated places by race or by income tend to have worse effects on kids' long-term prospects. Places with more inequality, and in particular, a smaller middle class, tend to be places with lower levels of upward mobility as well. We also find a strong correlation with measures of family structure. So places with more single parents tend to have lower rates of upward mobility. Importantly, in interpreting that correlation, it's useful to note that it holds even when you restrict to the subset of children whose own parents are married. So it's not directly driven by the fact that by whether your own parents are married or not. Rather, even if your own parents are married and you grow up in a place with a lot of single parents, on average, you seem to have worse outcomes in adulthood. Similar to that, we also find a very strong correlation with measures of social capital, so the degree of religious participation, indices of social capital constructed by Bob Putnam and his colleagues. You find that places like Salt Lake City with the Mormon Church, a place thought to have a lot of social capital, those kinds of places also tend to have high rates of intergenerational upward mobility. And then finally, as best we can measure the quality of schools, we look at things like class size, look at expenditures. All of these are pretty crude measures of the quality of schools. As you might expect, places with better public schools as measured in various ways also tend to have higher levels of mobility. Now, none of this is about causal effects, right? We don't know exactly what would happen if you manipulate any of these factors, and I think that remains to be figured out in future research, but it maybe gives us some hints about where to look as we go forward. So let me, I take 5 more minutes or should I wrap up? Okay, at most, all right. So let me show you one final set of results in a couple of minutes that think about these, come at these issues from a slightly different perspective. So traditionally, when we think about issues of social mobility, I think we're interested in these issues from principles of justice. So the idea that everyone should have a shot at the American dream regardless of their family background. I want to show one final set of results from some work we're doing now, which suggests that improving opportunities for upward mobility could also increase productivity and growth. So independent of equity issues, you might be interested in these in improving mobility just in terms of increasing the size of the economic pie. So to illustrate that, I'm going to focus on one specific pathway to upward mobility, which is innovation. Okay, and we're going to study the lives of 750,000 patent holders in the US by linking the universe of patent records to the tax data. So we're able to track the lives of inventors and see where inventors in America, as measured by patents, which are an imperfect proxy, of course, but capture something to do with innovation, where do these inventors come from? So let me start with this chart here, which shows you the probability of having a patent by age 30 versus your parents' income. You can see that you're much more likely to become an inventor as measured by having a patent if you're from a high-income family than a low-income family. If you happen to be born to parents in the top 1% of the income distribution, you're 10 times as likely to have a patent as if you happen to be born to parents at the median of the income distribution. So what's driving that relationship? There could be a variety of explanations, one of which could be differences in childhood environment and schools and the types of things I've been talking about, another of which could be differences in ability or in preferences. So perhaps, you know, the kids of parents in the top 1% are just more talented, maybe that's why they are more likely to become inventors. So we can discriminate between those explanations in a couple of ways. Let me show you one approach. We try to use measures of ability early in childhood as one way to discriminate between the ability versus environment explanation. So this chart here shows you patent rates versus your third grade math test score for a subset of kids for whom we have test score data linked into the tax records, children who went to New York City public schools. And each dot here represents 5% of the test score distribution. So you can see that if you're below something like the 90th percentile of your third grade math class, unfortunately, you're probably not gonna go on to have a patent or become an inventor, and then the probability really shoots up steeply in the upper tail, as you might expect intuitively. Now, more interestingly from the perspective of this talk, if we split that data out, looking at kids from relatively affluent families above the 80th percentile in the red, and below the 80th percentile, so middle class and lower income families in the blue, we see a striking pattern, which is that these high scoring kids are more likely to become inventors if they're from high income families, right? So if you're from a relatively lower income family, your odds of becoming an inventor don't look all that much higher, even if you're at the top of your third grade math class. So that is consistent with the idea that it's not just about differences in ability, and rather it might be about differences in access and opportunity that's leading to these differences in outcomes. Now, third grade math test scores are by no means a perfect measure of ability, so you can't be totally confident that that's what's going on based on this evidence. So let me show you one other angle on this that complements that. So let's return to the geographical variation and look now at the origins of inventors in the United States. So where did people who ultimately have got patents, where did they grow up? So what's your propensity to have a patent based on where you grow up? The redder colors here are areas that generate more inventors. The gray colors are places that generate fewer inventors. You can see that the Bay Area, for instance, is a hot spot in terms of producing inventors, the Northeast, but also other places. Notice, for instance, Austin, Texas stands out among the rest of Texas, parts of the Midwest, and so forth. Now, the generic pattern that you can kind of visually see in this map is that if you tend to grow up in a place where a lot of innovation is occurring, you yourself are much more likely to become an inventor. So that's consistent with the idea that exposure might matter. But it turns out that the pattern's actually much finer than that. So we then dig into the specific technology class in which kids innovate. And let me just explain what we do here with an example. So think about two kids who are currently in Boston, and say one of them grew up in Minneapolis, which has a lot of pharmaceutical companies, and one of them grew up in the Bay Area, which has a lot of computer technology. What we see is that the kid who grew up in Minneapolis is much more likely to have a patent in something like medical devices, and the kid who grew up in the Bay Area is much more likely to have a computer tech patent. So that's a broad categorization. Turns out even if you drill down to fine technology class levels, as you can see here, you know, demodulators versus modulators versus oscillators, you see that if you grew up around the guys who are innovating in modulators, you're more likely to exactly have the modulator patent, and similarly with the oscillators. So that, I think, unless you think that, you know, you have the oscillator gene versus the modulator gene, it suggests that some sort of very direct specific human capital exposure really matters in driving these patterns. And once again, if you think about lower income kids, they probably don't have, you know, those internships or other direct links that are leading to these outcomes for the higher income children. So I think that suggests that increasing mobility might not just increase the incomes of those children, but could lead to higher levels of innovation and ultimately contribute to economic growth more broadly. So let me conclude by just telling you a little bit about where we're headed, and then I'll stop. So I think the key question going forward is to learn more about how we can improve neighborhood environments for disadvantaged youth. In our research group, we're pursuing both of the approaches that I talked about earlier. So first, we're trying to figure out how we can help more families move to better neighborhoods in a large experimental project with Larry and other collaborators. We've developed a partnership with HUD and 15 large public housing authorities around the United States, where we're developing experimental interventions on both the supply and demand side, the landlord and tenant side of the housing market, to figure out how we can get more families to use this money they're already getting to raise their kids in what appear to be higher opportunity areas. On the second prong, we're also trying to study how we can improve neighborhoods with low levels of upward mobility, the place-based approach. And we're doing a couple of things there. This is a challenging question, a couple of things on that path. So first, the definitions of neighborhoods that I've been using are very broad, right, at the county or commuting zone level. So the first thing we're doing is trying to construct mobility statistics at a much finer level by geocoding the population at the census tract level. And our hope is to maybe conduct ethnographic studies of outlier places, places that look unusually good or bad, in combination with sociologists and ethnographers. The other approach we're thinking about is trying to think about neighborhoods as networks. As I was showing you with that patent evidence, it seems like very specific connections matter here. And so one of the things I've been talking about with my colleague Matt Jackson at Stanford is working with Facebook data to see whether the friendship networks in places like San Francisco, where we see more mobility, are they more likely to straddle socioeconomic boundaries, for instance, than in places like Atlanta? And more generally, how might we manipulate networks to increase mobility going forward? There's much more to be done on these issues. I think we're just scratching the surface on these questions. And so let me end by just pointing out that all of the data I've been showing you in this talk is publicly available by county and by commuting zone and by birth cohort. And so I hope some of you will find that useful in your own work to study these important questions. Thanks very much.
To honor pathbreaking work in labor economics that has been